This is Book Club Cheats, a podcast for book clubbers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Lippy Turner Roman, and today we'll be talking about The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. A couple of Christmases ago, my mother-in-law received one of those Ancestry DNA kits. It was exciting and a lot of fun learning about the different ethnicities and races that lived within her, and obviously were a part of my children too. Race, ethnicity, and skin colour are issues that have enormous consequences in the US. The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett explores these issues and the ramification of the uniquely American phenomena of passing. A feature of American slavery was the non-consensual sex between slave-owning classes and their slave captives. Rape, really. Passing is when light-skinned African Americans escaped racism by passing as white and disappearing into white spaces. The Vanishing Half is a historical fiction genre. The book explores the lives of two sisters, Stella and Desiree, and their daughters, Jude and Kennedy, over a 40-year period. The twins may look the same, but they end up experiencing totally different Americas. The book is divided into four parts, which transverses the periods of 1954, 1968, 1978, and 1984. Britt Bennett was inspired to write The Vanishing Half after she heard from her mother about a town of white-skinned blacks in Louisiana. Stella and Desiree are identical twins. They're so light they could pass for whites easily. Their ancestor, a son of a slave and a slaveholder, founded the town of Mallard, Louisiana, as a unique community of light-skinned African-Americans. Mallard is conceived of as a third space, a place where each generation of African-Americans would be lighter than the one before. A place for people not wholly accepted in either white or African-American communities. When the twins were little, their father, Leon, is dragged out and lynched. Desiree and Stella watched this horrific act, hiding inside a wardrobe. Leon barely survived. The white men finished lynching Leon the next day at the hospital. A reserved, melancholy Stella becomes even more introverted, allowing her twin Desiree to speak for her and being plagued by fearful nightmares. Desiree is bored in and with Mallard. She desperately wants to get out of Mallard. Desiree wants to be an actress and longs for excitement and travel. Stella, on the other hand, is content in Mallard, loves school and dreams of college and a career in teaching. When their cash-strapped mother, Adele, makes the twins drop out of school to clean houses for the rich white folks, Desiree and Stella run away to New Orleans. The twins plan to get a good job for Stella first and then one for Desiree. The girls bunk with another girl from Mallard, Farah, but they soon get a place of their own. Initially, the sisters work at a laundry, but Stella gets fired and Desiree makes her apply for a position at a white department store since they need the money. Stella doesn't reveal that she's black and is hired on as a secretary very quickly. One day, Desiree comes home to find Stella has abandoned her. Stella's left a note telling Desiree, "Sorry, honey, but I gotta go my own way." Desiree is shocked, sad, bereft, and angry. She's lost a part of herself. Desiree ends up in Washington, D.C. She trains as a fingerprint expert for the FBI. Desiree meets, falls in love, and marries Sam, a very black-skinned African-American lawyer. They have a baby girl, Jude, who takes after her father in colouring. A lovely apartment, great jobs, living the dream, right? Well, things go downhill pretty fast after the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King. Sam repeatedly beats and batters Desiree, sometimes in front of Jude. It's almost as if Sam is paying Desiree back for looking white, or as he tells Jude, for thinking that she's better than us. Desiree runs away with Jude and goes back to Mallard. She only intends to stay for a couple of weeks until she figures out what to do, but ultimately ends up staying in Mallard for 20 years. Desiree attempts to get employed as a fingerprint expert at the sheriff's office in the nearby town. The sheriff is really interested, but as soon as Desiree starts to put down that she's coloured, he tells her to stop filling out the application. He's not interested now. Desiree has no choice but to get a spoon at Mallard's diner. She ends up basically running the restaurant for the next 20 years. Sam hires Early Jones, a people finder, to track down Desiree and Jude. Early takes the case only because he knows Desiree. He had a thing for her when he briefly lived in Mallard when he was 17. But Desiree's mother, Adele, squashed their romance by warning Desiree that Early was too dark and no good. Early still has a thing for Desiree, and so throws Sam permanently off the scent. He offers to help find Stella for Desiree. Desiree misses her twin powerfully, and being back in Mallard, she sees Stella in every corner. Adele tells Desiree and Early that Stella doesn't want to be found, that she had passed as white before, when she lived in Mallard. In New Orleans, Early and Desiree learn from Farah that Stella had a white boyfriend when she lived there. When Farah happened on them, Stella looked right through her. Early and Desiree track Stella up to Massachusetts, but the trail goes cold. But Desiree never gives up hope of finding Stella. Desiree and Early have sex and form a long and loving relationship. The people of Ballard are obsessed with whiteness and steeped in colorism and racism, just like the white people surrounding Mallard. Dark, lean, and rangy, just like her father, Jude has been alienated, stigmatized, and mentally and sometimes physically segregated by Mallard. What was meant to be a couple of weeks stretches to 10 hard, long years for Jude. She has no friends and has never felt welcomed or embraced by the people in Mallard. Jude is constantly aware and reminded of her dark skin. Even though Jude longs to swim in the river with all the other kids, she never does, since it would mean uncovering herself and revealing her dark skin. Jude spends a lot of time waiting for her mom in the diner. Early is there for Jude, but he's in Mallard infrequently since he's tracking people down. Early gives Jude running shoes, and running becomes an escape and a happy place for Jude. And even though Jude has a great relationship with Early, she longs for her real dad. Jude and Desiree have a good and loving relationship. They're open and honest with each other. Jude goes to UCLA on a full track scholarship. At a party, Jude meets Reese, a dark-skinned African-American photographer who has a little bit of a complex about being dark himself, and they start a relationship. Reese was actually born Therese Ann Carter. After being caught kissing a girl, Reese's father throws him out. On the long road to Los Angeles, Reese sheds all remnants of Therese Ann Carter and becomes the person he was meant to be. At one point, Reese wonders how it's possible to be two different people in one lifetime. In the same way that Jude never uncovered herself in Mallard, Reese never fully uncovers himself with Jude, even when they're making love. He hides in the dark. Reese works numerous jobs to purchase the testosterone he needs and is saving up for reconstructive surgery. Reese's friends in the LGBT community become Jude's friends and form a supportive unit for the couple. Working part-time at a ritzy party, Jude encounters Kennedy, a rich, spoiled white girl, and thinks she sees Stella. Astonished, Jude drops wine all over the fancy carpet and is fired. We finally meet up with Stella, who has carefully crafted and molded herself into a person far, far removed from Mallard. Stella is living the good life. She has a fancy house, has maids, talks differently, is a rich, bored white housewife. Stella is also very scared. Scared she'll be found out, scared that she'll be outed as black. She's not had a day's peace since she passed as white and married her former boss, Blake Saunders. Re-encounter Stella in 1978 as she's trying to stop a black family, the Walkers, from moving into her all-white neighborhood. Even though Stella's never spoken kindly of a Negro, her vehement and forceful denunciation at the neighborhood association embarrasses even her own husband. Blake has a subtle racism, no need to shout it out. Stella ran to get freedom, but she's still living in a prison, not being able to be at home, to be herself, to her racist husband, to all the people who purport to be her friend, to her daughter. Her father's lynching also still traumatizes her. She sleeps with a baseball bat under her pillow, and sometimes, when Blake touches her, makes love to her, Stella sees the other red-haired man who dragged her father from the house and lynched him. Even though Desiree wanted to be the actor, it's actually Stella who is the real actor in the family. We voyage with Stella as she's molested by the husband of the woman she cleaned for as a young girl, as she visited and passed as white a museum and a shop in town over from Mallard. How easy it was, and how she permanently passed over. At the department store in New Orleans, Stella becomes Blake Saunders' white secretary. Blake likes her, takes her out to dinner, and when he returns to Boston, asks her to come as his secretary. On the bus over to work every day, Stella preps herself as if taking on a role to become the white Miss Vignes. But Stella can only be Miss Vignes when Desiree is not around. Stella realizes that there's an act and an art to being white. And Stella becomes white only because everyone else thought she was and let her. Stella tells herself she didn't plan to leave her sister. It just happened. And that she'd left Desiree even while they were really in New Orleans. Reginald and Loretta Walker are allowed to move into Stella's neighborhood after threatening a lawsuit. Reg is an actor on a popular cop show. The neighborhood women don't want anything to do with Loretta. They don't want to know her. But Stella's drawn to Loretta and her friends. She takes a welcome cake over and starts to form a strange friendship with Loretta. Stella misses the warmth of her own people. Stella tells herself that she's split in two, that she's been two people her whole life. Blake wants to know why Stella's mixing with the Walkers, why she's friends with Loretta. People are talking and it's imperiling their standing in the neighborhood. If she's bored, Blake thinks Stella should take a class in flower arranging or something like that. One day, Kennedy puts an end to the burgeoning relationship. Page 198. In the kitchen, she mashed potatoes until her arms burned. She slid pineapple wedges into the folds of the ham and pushed it into the oven. Blake, watching the Lakers wallop the Suns, told her that Kennedy had gone outside to play with the other neighborhood kids. But when she stepped outside, she didn't see the Pearson boys racing bicycles past or the Johansson girls tugging their wagons or anyone else tossing a football. No children at all. Their cul-de-sac empty except for Kennedy and Cindy on the Walker's lawn, both girls crying, Loretta kneeling between them, frazzled, still in her apron. Stella ran across the street, grabbed her daughter, searched her skin for cuts and scrapes, but she didn't find any, so she pulled Kennedy in for a hug instead. What's the matter? She asked Loretta. Did something happen? A fight over a new toy, maybe. Talking Barbie was lying in the dirt between them. But Loretta stood, grabbing her daughter's hand. You should know, she said. Her voice was strangely cold. Maybe she had heard the music from the party last night. Maybe she was still sore about not being invited. Stella stroked her daughter's hair. You have to share, honey, she said. What did Mommy tell you about that? I'm sorry, Loretta. She's only a child, you know.
Oh, she shared plenty, Loretta said. Keep her away from my girl.
What?
Stella stood, gripping Kennedy's shoulder protectively. What are you talking about?
You know what she said to Cindy? Well, the girls were playing some game and Kennedy was losing. She said, I don't want to play with a nigger. Her stomach sank. Loretta,
No, I understand, Loretta said. I don't blame her. It all comes from the home, see? And like a fool, I let you into mine. The loneliest goddamn woman in this whole neighborhood. I should have known. You stay away from me.
Loretta quivered, powerless in her anger, and all the angrier for it. Stella felt numb. She guided her daughter back across the street. As soon as she shut the door, she grabbed Kennedy and slapped her. The girl yelped. What do I do? She asked, crying again. Behind her, the crowd on the television roared, Blake cheering along. Stella stared into her daughter's face, seeing everyone that she'd ever hated. Then she looked at her daughter again, gazing at her with watery eyes, a hand covering her reddened face. Stella fell to her knees, pulling her daughter close, kissing her damp face. I don't know, she said. I don't know. Mommy's sorry.
The Walkers leave Brentwood after someone throws a brick through their window. Really, they're terrorized out.
A depressed and lost Stella feels like she's lost Desiree all over again. Stella gets her GED and an advanced degree in math and becomes an adjunct math professor. This creates some friction between Blake and herself. Kennedy drops out of college to be an actor, driving Stella crazy. Stella feels Kennedy doesn't know or appreciate what she's sacrificed for her. Stella wants Kennedy to go back to school, and Blake wants Stella to quit her job. Jude is obsessed with the absent Stella. Jude and Kennedy reconnect when Jude takes a part-time job in the theatre Kennedy is performing in. Kennedy reveals to Jude her mother's name and the town she's from. Stella comes to Kennedy's last performance. In the intermission, Jude follows Stella out and tells her that she's her niece. Stella freaks out. Jude proceeds to tell Kennedy all about Stella and Desiree and informs Kennedy that her mother's been lying to her whole life. Kennedy knows her mother lies to her and confronts Stella, asking her, "Why don't you let me know you?" Stella lies and says that Jade is lying and trying to shake her down. Kennedy moves to New York, and when she returns to California on the ride home from the airport, Stella is ready to have Kennedy ask her anything, as long as she doesn't talk about it when they're home. Stella covers a lifetime in the 11 miles from the airport to home. Kennedy understands that secrets and lies are the only language Stella and she can speak. Kennedy knew at a very early stage that Stella lied to her, and Stella showed her love by lying, and in time, Kennedy did the same. Adele has Alzheimer's and is not well. She misses Stella and confuses Desiree for her all the time, asking where she went. Desiree wraps her arms around her mother, pretends to be Stella, and tells her mother she never went anywhere. She's right here. Early and Adele return from a fishing trip one day to find Stella at the entrance to the house, and even after 30 odd years, Adele instantly recognizes that it's Stella. Page 318. She's different now. The words pass through each twin's mind. Desiree eyeing how Stella held her knife and fork, barely gripping the metal. Stella noticing how boldly Desiree moved around the kitchen now. Desiree watching Stella rub the back of her neck, a gesture that seemed so wearied it startled her. Stella listening to Desiree speak to their mother, her voice soft and soothing. And all the while, to Adele Vignes, the twins were the same as they'd ever been. Time was collapsing and expanding. The twins were different and the same all at once. There could have been 50 pairs of twins sitting at that dinner table, a seat for each person they had been since they had spoken last, a battered wife and a bored one, a waitress and a professor, each woman seated next to a stranger. Instead, there were only the twins, early sitting between them. He felt, watching Stella primly cut her fish, that he didn't know Desiree at all, that maybe it was impossible to know one without the other. After dinner, he cleared the dishes while the twins stepped out onto the front porch, Desiree carrying a dusty bottle of gin that she'd found in the back of the pantry. She'd brought it out even though she didn't know if Stella even liked gin, but Stella's eyes drifted to the bottle, then back to hers, and Desiree felt the thrill of a silent conversation. She smuggled it outside, Stella trailing after her. "Don't you all stay out too late," their mother called. "It's a school night." Now they pass the bottle lazily between them, wincing through the sips of that ancient gin, which had been a wedding gift from Marie Vignes. The decors had been scandalized. What a present to get from your mother-in-law. And somehow, the controversial bottle had been forgotten over the years. Desiree sipped, then Stella, the twins falling into an easy rhythm. "You talk different now," Desiree said. "What do you mean?" Stella asked. "Like that. What do you mean? How do you learn to talk like that?" Stella paused, then smiled. "Television," she said. "I used to watch hours of it, just to learn how to sound like them." "Jesus," Desiree said. "I still can't believe you did it, Stella." "It ain't so hard. You could have done it." "You didn't want me to. You left me." God, Desiree hated how wounded she sounded. After all these years,
whining like a child abandoned on the playground. It wasn't that, Stella said. I met someone.
You did all this for a man?
Not for him, she said. I just liked who I was with him.
White?
No, Stella said.
Free.
Desiree laughed. Same thing, baby. She took another sip of gin, swallowing hard. Well, who was he? Again, Stella paused. Mr. Sanders, she finally said. In spite of everything, Desiree laughed. She laughed harder than she had in weeks, years even. Laughed until Stella, laughing too, snatched the bottle out of her hands before she knocked it over.
Mr. Sanders, she said. That old boss of yours? You ran off with him?
Farah said, Farah Tybo? I haven't thought about her in years. She said she'd seen you with a man.
Whatever happened to her?
I don't know. This was years ago. She married some alderman.
A politician's wife? Can you believe it?
The twins, laughing, talking over each other again, churning their way through that bottle. Desiree looking out for their mother, the way she'd done when they were teenagers smoking on the porch. She was a little drunk by then. She didn't know how late it was.
How do you do that?
She said.
All those years.
I had to keep going, Stella said. You can't turn back when you have a family, when you have people that depend on you.
You had family, Desiree said.
Oh, that's not what I mean, Stella said, looking away. It's different with a child. You know that.
But that... What was different, exactly?
A sister easier to shed than a daughter? A mother than a husband?
What made her so easy to give away?
But she didn't ask this, of course. She would have felt even more like a child than she already did, glancing over her shoulder to make sure her mother didn't catch her drinking. So it's you and Mr. Sanders, Blake.
You and Blake and...
We have a daughter, Stella said. Kennedy. Desiree tried to imagine her. For some reason, she could only envision a proper little white girl posed on a piano bench, her hands folded in her lap. Just so.
So what's she like? Desiree said.
Your girl. Willful, charming. She's an actor.
An actor?
She does little plays in New York. Not Broadway or anything. Still, Desiree said. An actor. And maybe you can bring her next time.
She knew she'd said the wrong thing when Stella glanced away.
A tiny look, but one that Desiree could still read.
When their eyes met again, Stella's were full of tears.
You know I can't, she said.
Why not?
Your daughter?
What about her?
She found me, Desiree, in Los Angeles. That's why I'm here.
Desiree scoffed. How could Jude have found Stella? Her daughter, a college student, stumbling on her in a city as large as Los Angeles. And if she had somehow found Stella, her daughter would have told her. She'd never kept a secret like that from her.
She didn't tell you, Stella said. I don't blame her. I was awful. I didn't mean to be. I was scared. Some girl showing up out of nowhere, saying she knows me. She looked nothing like you, you know. What was I supposed to think? But she found my daughter. Told her all about me, about Mallard. Then she pops up in New York.
Desiree pushed off the porch step.
She had to call Jude. She didn't care if it was late. That she was tipsy. That Stella was miraculously sitting on her front porch. But Stella grabbed her wrists.
Desiree, please, she said. Just listen to me. Just be reasonable.
I've been reasonable.
She'll never stop. Your girl will... keep trying to tell mine the truth, and it's too late for all that now. Can't you see that?
Oh, sure, it's the end of the world. Your girl finding out she ain't so lily white.
That I lied to her, Stella said. She'll never forgive me.
You don't understand, Desiree.
You're a good mother, I can see that. Your girl loves you.
That's why she didn't tell you about me.
But I haven't been a good one. I spent so long hiding.
Because you chose to, you wanted to.
I know, Stella said. I know, but please, 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 Desiree, don't take her away from me.
She bent over, crying into her hands, exhausted.
Desiree turned to the step behind her.
She wrapped an arm around Stella's shoulders, staring at the nape of her neck, pretending not to see the grey hair threading through the black.
She'd always felt like the older sister,
even though she was only older by a matter of minutes. But maybe in those 7 minutes, they'd first been apart. They'd each lived a lifetime, setting out on their separate paths, each discovering who she might be. The sisters sleep in the bed they had shared so long ago across from one another, just as they had done when they were younger, whispering all night long. Stella steals out the next morning without telling Desiree or her mom and gives Early her wedding ring to take care of Adele. Jude later on calls Kennedy to tell her that their grandmother died. The cousins keep in touch occasionally by intermittent phone calls all their lives. At Adele's funeral lunch, the people of Mallard turn out in force. Half are there to see if Jude really is in med school, and the other half are convinced that Desiree made up all the things her dark daughter accomplished. Reese and Jude don't go back to their lunch. They're skinny dipping in the river, finally revealing their whole naked selves to each other. And Desiree? Well, Desiree and Early are happy and content. They leave Mallard and move to Houston. Desiree becomes a surrogate mother to all the other workers at the call center where she works. People stay on the line to listen to her. Page 342. "You got a sweet little voice," Early told her once, grinning at her across their porch. But what seemed more likely is that people were lonely. Sometimes she imagined Cole calling Stella. Would she recognize her voice? Would it still sound like her own? Or would Stella sound like a lonely person who wanted her to keep talking just to hear another voice on the line? I loved, loved, loved this book. The Vanishing Half really blew me away. I started the book late, only aiming to read just a chapter before bed. I know, bad mistake. I just kept reading on and on. It's such an engaging and absorbing book. It's a bittersweet, multi-generational family saga with an intricate plotline which just drew me in. I finished it in one sitting, went to bed at 3 o'clock, and it's not something I would advise, especially if you have to give a presentation the next morning. Bad mistake. Britt Bennett is a phenomenal writer. Her intricate prose does an amazing job of conveying a textured complexity while being really approachable. The book is engaging, insightful, and an easy read, but the material, prose, and imagery have real teeth. The Vanishing Half covers a lot of ground. Race, identity, motherhood, gender, colorism, domestic abuse, racism, class, feelings of alienation, belonging, and loneliness. Gosh, Bennett gets through a lot of topics in a very concise manner. However, she never feels preachy. I was left thinking about the issues it raised long after I finished the book. It's a character-driven story, and it's told from multiple points of view. We hear Desiree, Stella, Early's, Jude, Kennedy's, and Reese's voices. I come from a big and close family, and what spoke to me about The Vanishing Half was the relationships between the sisters, mothers, daughters, and cousins. Characters serve as foils for each other. Desiree and Stella, Kennedy and Jude, Stella and Reese, Early and Blake. The sisters are foils for each other. Desiree is a dreamer, impulsive, a procrastinator, a performer, open, whereas Stella is logical, calm, practical, and secretive. Each twin's character traits sort of cancel each other out, really, in a way, or do they make a greater whole? It's interesting. I don't know. When Stella returns to Mallard and she and Desiree hug, a customer comments that the twins disappeared into one another. He couldn't tell which twin was which. And I think the characters together sort of absorb and make a whole or cancel each other out, if you will. Desiree and Stella have daughters who mirror personality traits of their aunts rather than their mothers. So Kennedy is a performer, a dreamer, and appears really easygoing, whereas Jude is studious, quiet, reserved, and practical. Each mother-daughter relationship also sort of serves as a foil. Stella's relationship with Kennedy is fraught with tensions, lies, and secrets, and unfulfilled promises and expectations. But Desiree's relationship with Jude feels is honest, open, nurturing, Although Jude does keep things from her mom, such as not telling Desiree about finding Stella and the full facts about why she cannot legally marry Reese. The Vanishing Half tackles the issues and privileges of colorism. We see the internalized hatred and racism some black characters have for other black characters based on how dark their skin color is. Black skin characters are marked as lazy and problematic, while lighter-skinned blacks enjoy higher esteem. The book concisely demonstrates the way certain groups of people gain self-esteem by oppressing other groups, and The Vanishing Half tackles the casual and pervasive racism that really does exist in American society. Blake and his neighbours in Brentwood view themselves as good and kind and liberal people who are polite to African Americans, but laugh at racist jokes and feel that their kind belong on the other side of the tracks and not really in their neighbourhoods. I just kept thinking about how Blake would feel, what he would say if he ever knew the truth about his wife. Stella's passing, her becoming white, really highlighted the absurdities of race in America and the way whiteness is seen as a badge of safety. I found it interesting that Stella tells Desiree she passed because she liked the way how she was with Blake, how he made her feel, or it made her feel, free. I found that ironic since I didn't feel that Stella was free at all. She lived a life of servitude, tied to her lies, living with the emotional toll of living a lie, and never being truly free to be herself, and never truly expressing herself or allowing others to see her. I know that she passed in order to gain opportunities that being white afforded, to be in that white space. I mean, she obviously hit the jackpot in terms of material wealth, but I didn't feel that she was happy or really free. Stella's passing into whiteness also highlights the loss that comes with being white, that loss of self, community, truth, family and history, not just for herself, but also for Kennedy. At the end of the book, we sense that Stella and Desiree will never meet again, and my heart broke. Bennett allows her characters to shine, and she doesn't judge them, but I have to be honest, I just like Desiree more than Stella. I wanted to know more about Desiree's hopes and dreams and life. I felt like the book shone when it spotlighted the sisters and dimmed somewhat with the continued focus on their daughters. As I mentioned before, Bennett gets a lot into her 343 pages. The other subtle quibble that I had with the book was that it did fall into a sort of a familiar trope of the tragic mulatto, the biracial, that other books that dealt with sort of similar subject about passing, such as Imitation of Life, were criticized for. Okay, here are some book club questions. What did Stella lose by being black? What did she gain by passing, by becoming white? How do you feel about the morality of the act of passing? How do the choices Desiree and Stella make affect the people around them? And how do their mothers mold Kennedy and Jude? What parts vanish and what part stays the same for each character throughout The Vanishing Half? How do we construct ourselves, our identities, and what do we really know about each other? How much honesty should our family members expect from us? To be accepted for whom we are inside rather than what is on the outside is a noble aim. How do we get to this place in this time? Bennett's previous book, The Mothers, is on my to-read pile right now. The Vanishing Half is a wonderful book, and I really hope you get a chance to read it. But don't start it the night before a presentation. Bye-bye.